From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on November 23rd, 1963, on BBC One, the British Broadcasting Channel. A show called Doctor Who launched, dividing the human race into Whovians and Who Caresvians. To this day, Doctor Who retains its devoted following. It ran on the BBC for 26 years in its original form, then returned for new seasons in recent years. And you might have seen the recent news. On July 16th, the BBC announced that Jodie Whittaker will become the first female Doctor Who. 12 men have preceded her, and the announcement sparked celebrations in many circles with adorable viral videos of young girls reacting to the news with utter joy. A woman is Doctor Who, indeed. And of course, there was some predictable backlash. I don't want to overplay it, but from my perspective, the backlash was kind of tepid, but nonetheless there, particularly on social media, where trolls employ all of their courage to create fake usernames like Pepe Says, while attacking a broadcast network for daring to recognize that women are not simply hanging around to serve men dinner. Why do some people do this? Why is it that there is a backlash, no matter how big, when news arises that the next James Bond might be a black actor? Why do we argue over the race of Santa Claus? Why can't the Ghostbusters be women? They can, of course, because they're fictional characters, and fiction can be anything we darn well please. This hour, a conversation about that, from Doctor Who to James Bond to Santa Claus and everything in between. My guests include Eileen Daly-Boas, who's an outreach librarian for the River Campus Libraries at the University of Rochester, and a Whovian. That's the term?
That's the term.
I want to make sure. Because I'm not, but that doesn't mean I don't respect it. I've just never seen it, and I'm scared that if it's like a potato chip, if I watch an episode, I'm probably like, oh no.
Definitely. You've got many years to watch.
Thank you for being here, Eileen. Also a Whovian is Jeremy Sarakin, an associate professor and program director for digital cultures and technologies and chair of the media and communication department at St. John Fisher College. Jeremy, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Irene Canyo is creator, executive producer, and co-host of No Labels Included on WAO 104.3. Nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
And also here is Chris Thompson. He's a comedian, a writer, an activist. He's a contributor of the Almost Tuesday show on WAO, and he is the man behind the blog The Chronicles of Nonsense. Chris, welcome back to you.
Hey.
What is that shirt? That is awesome, by the way.
Oh, this is a special shirt I found online. It's Princess Leia imagined as a black woman. So instead of those cinnamon bun things, she's got Afro puffs. Still rocking a laser.
The blaster?
Laser gun. Yes. Yeah. Laser blaster. That's
There you go. It looks great. So, yeah. All right. Well, a lot to unpack here. Eileen, as a Whovian and the female Whovian here, what were your thoughts when you heard Jodie Whittaker?
I wasn't too surprised. I knew Chris Chibnall was going to be the showrunner, and he did Broadchurch, so I wasn't too surprised that he picked somebody out of Broadchurch. I was really excited. I could see it was coming. There was a main bad guy who was called the Master, and they made the Master into Missy, a woman, and she's fantastic, Michelle Gomez. And I think that was so successful that I wasn't too surprised that they were headed towards picking a woman. And Jodie Whittaker is good, so I think I'm looking forward to it.
And Eileen, I don't know much about the series. I have read that, I don't know if it was one of the recent writers or people behind the series, even going back 10 years or so, have talked about putting a woman in that role, yes?
Yeah, they've increasingly made women, I think, stronger and more forceful characters, going back to like Amy Pond, right, who sort of almost played an equal role with the Doctor at times. So I think they've been leaning towards it. Certainly Doctor Who in the last 8 years has become much more diverse. They've tried in an episode this season, they had a little person. So they're really trying to just make sure the show is for everybody and everyone's represented. They do a pretty good job. So.
Okay. And when it comes to why people love the show, you know, we're not going to make it a Doctor Who hour. We've got a lot to talk about in a lot of different places here.
I'm out of here.
Why do you love it, Eileen?
So I'm at the library. I'm the philosophy librarian because I have my master's in philosophy, and what I worked on was metaphysics. So problems like time travel and identity and, you know, artificial intelligence, those have always been the things that I was attracted to. And I was a Tom Baker fangirl, and Doctor Who all the way through has talked about those really interesting issues. Can you go back and kill your grandfather? What happens if you split in time?
And so, wait, what is the answer? Can you go back and kill your grandfather?
No, you can't.
You can't.
If you can, then he wasn't really your grandfather, or you're in a parallel universe. So
that'd be a terrible way to find out he wasn't your grandfather.
Exactly. Well, you could always be in a parallel universe, so it's an identical copy, but not in your timeline. So you have to do different timeline. So, yes,
so it's fun. So it explores these concepts that you've enjoyed. Okay.
Exactly. So that's ever since I was a kid, Land of the Lost, Voyagers, Quantum Leap, all those issues have been interesting to me. And so something like Doctor Who, just there are no rules. They can investigate any of these really interesting, whether it's ethical or metaphysical, or just fun issues. And there's always a bad guy, bad monster of the week. So.
Jeremy, one thing I wanted to do, and again, you know, you're program director for Digital Cultures and Technologies and chair of the Media and Communication Department, right. And I think you'd be sensitive to what I'm about to say, which is I did not want to overplay the backlash. I don't think the backlash has been all that strong from what I can perceive myself. That doesn't mean it's difficult to find really ugly stuff out there, ugly tweets, usually white males hiding behind a green frog caricature, mm-hmm. you know, talking about how this ruins the series or whatever. I don't know why it would, and that depresses me. Happily, there are these beautiful little videos of there's this British girl watching, and Eileen's immediately, isn't that awesome? When she's watching the announcement and then she realizes Doctor Who's about to be a woman, her reaction's awesome.
Doctor Who is a woman!
Right.
it's really beautiful, but Jeremy, should I be depressed at all that there's still a backlash at all? Should we just not talk about it? Does that give it oxygen? Or do we need to confront the fact that this is still, you know, sort of who we are as a human race here, and we have to keep sort of stamping that out?
Right. I think that's right. I think very much social media, to some extent, has made us aware of this. I mean, I think there would have been individuals who weren't happy about the situation, for whatever reason. But then they wouldn't have really gotten any kind of way to broadcast that. And so because of social media, because of comments on YouTube, they're able to say, you know, I don't like this, and then they sort of feed off of each other. I would agree that I think, one, most people are either happy about it or don't care. I mean, the fact of the matter is that people watching Doctor Who, and I'm one of them, is still, you know, a fairly small population, at least in the States. In England, it's much bigger. But I think sort of our current social media climate has created this. I mean, I think the other thing that's interesting about this is that it sort of reflects a lot of what the country is going through right now in terms of issues of diversity, issues of representation, how people feel about people in different roles. Just on social media yesterday, there was this picture of all of President Trump's interns and how much there's not really any diversity there to speak of.
I don't think any.
Or any. I think there was, you know, one or two people out of like 100. And so this issue is a big thing. And so somehow this seems to have just come at a time, one, where it's needed, but also where people want to either be angry about it or want to praise it more than they might have anyways.
Yeah, that reminded me, that White House photo reminded me of one of my favorite shows was The Tick. And The Tick is coming back.
Yeah.
The Tick is
yes.
coming back. And
great.
There was a live action version that lasted for 9 episodes total with Patrick Warburton as The Tick. Mm-hmm. And there was one where he and Arthur get brought into the, I think, like this super league of superheroes. And they go to their first cocktail party and he realizes there's no diversity there. And Arthur is freaking out and The Tick is just sort of oblivious. And he says, Arthur, the cream rises to the top, and the cream sure is white. Yeah, yeah, and it kind of speaks to what Jeremy is saying here. I mean, you know, sometimes it hits you like a hammer that people are just so uncomfortable. Irene had to be shocked that there were people who didn't want a woman as Doctor Who. It probably just really surprised you, huh?
Oh, yeah. America surprises me every day, though, you know. When you were talking about social media, I thought about a little bit of a tangent, but the social media hashtag OscarsSoWhite that was in 2015, mm-hmm. That came out and spurred a lot of these conversations about inclusion for people of color and women. I found a study online that was released in 2016 that was kind of part of the response to the OscarsSoWhite. It was called the Inclusion or Invisibility Study, Comprehensive Annenberg Report on Diversity in Entertainment. And only 1/3 of speaking characters in the U.S. were found to be female. And this was 2016, so I feel like this problem is still, it seems like something as exciting as having a female Doctor Who is progress, but there's still a lot of work to go, so.
I think that's a great point. And that, for me, reminds me of a concept that we briefly discussed here recently, and I'll bring it up again, which is the idea of moral licensing. And I will give, begrudgingly, I will give Malcolm Gladwell credit for that because he did an episode on his podcast in which he looked at all of the countries that have elected all of one female head of state and then never again. And the idea of moral licensing is you do something that makes you feel good and you think that it shows that you are sort of evolved or progressive, but then you go, you fall back into your ways of closing the door toward inclusion.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's the same kind of thing. Well, the minute that an actor of color wins an Oscar statue, how many years will it be before another one?
Right,
the same kind of moral licensing, right? So we have to be sort of on guard against that.
Yeah, so I think it's cool. Like, we should definitely celebrate Jodie Whittaker being Doctor Who, and then we should continue to have the momentum so that those, maybe some of those little girls that we're celebrating that want to be actresses, can have a chance to play as large of a role in the future.
Right. Moral licensing says the next 12 doctors are likely to be males, just because. But we'll see. I mean, the idea is, if you talk about this enough and you own it, maybe that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Chris Thompson, let me ask you, you know, your thoughts, because you're not a Whovian.
I'm not.
But but we're about to get into some other, you know, areas where this has come up here. And my guess is you were also not surprised that there was any backlash about, you know, a change in a white male being a lead character in a franchise.
You know, I was... I saw the backlash, and I saw the people were surprised by it. And I keep joking that I'm going to make a podcast called Things Black Folk Have Been Known That White Folk Are Just Figuring Out. Because this happens every time. It happened when it was announced that there was going to be a black Spider-Man, not even in the main universe. Like, in some alternate universe, there's going to be a Spider-Man who's black. Because God forbid, in New York City, one of the most diverse cities in the world, there are like people of color with superpowers. You know, it happened with, I wrote them all down. Yeah, it happened. It happens a lot. It happened when Valkyrie was cast in the new Thor. It's a woman named Tessa Thompson who happens to be black. She's going to play the superhero Valkyrie. And it looks great. You know, this keeps happening, but it never happens whenever, you know, Gods of Egypt comes out with an all-white cast.
Right.
So, yeah, I wasn't surprised. And I noticed, and I was talking about this with y'all downstairs, like, a lot of the people who were making the complaints, it doesn't sound like they ever watched, like, an episode of Doctor Who. They were complaining to complain.
That's an interesting point. What do you think of that?
Right, no, I mean, I'll add that. I mean, in the last year, the doctor travels with a companion, and the companion's actually been a black woman who's also gay. The show has been very progressive for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so this actually isn't a big jump, which I think points to the fact that if people are complaining about what the show is doing, they're not actually watching the show. And if they have certain feelings against this, then it's unlikely they would keep watching the show for a while now.
Let me play a little audio for you of some of the kinds of reaction that Chris is talking about. That in Chris's words, black people are not at all surprised that, and white people are like, what? The outrage over Idris Elba as a possible James Bond.
Right, right.
Ooh, fun.
And so here is comedian and entertainer Rush Limbaugh talking about the idea of a black James Bond.
He was white and Scottish. Period. That is who James Bond is. And I know it's racist to probably even point this out. But the franchise needs to get with it, right? The franchise needs to get hip. The franchise needs to get with the 21st century. Well, that's right. We have 50 years of white Bonds because Bond is white. Bond was never black. Ian Fleming never created a black Brit to play James Bond. The character was always white. He was always Scottish.
Listen to how threatened he feels that it might not be a white James Bond, Chris. What do you think?
Man, he's going to be really upset when he finds out there are black Scots.
I know.
Has he heard of, like, European colonization?
The
like, there are black Scots right now. They're wearing kilts and being Scottish as hell.
They might even be in MI5,
right. MI6. They could be in MI5 and MI6.
And I'm wondering how he... I mean, I haven't really read the James Bond books, but does he ever say, Ian Fleming ever say, white? Like, I bet he doesn't.
No, he doesn't say he doesn't say white, but, like, every once in a while, you'll see something like his steely blue eyes or something. But he always had dark hair in the book. But the thing is, the franchise, the movie franchise, has moved so far away from the books.
And they always do. Yeah, of course. A lot of them do. So I don't understand that.
So, yeah, like now James Bond isn't just his you know, his given name. James Bond is just a code name title for that 007 agent. So anybody, a woman could be James Bond at this point.
We
so,
don't know.
Yeah, his complaints
it's a fictional character, people.
Are humorous. Exactly. Yes, also, this guy never existed.
Yeah.
It's important.
There's that whole piece.
Yeah, you want to, I mean, these are fictional characters, and it's like people just want to own these characters and not allow a new idea of
the character.
You
know, a lot of things that were, was James Bond adapted from books? I believe it was. So a lot of these characters that become like movie characters, it's all about the creative direction of whoever's making the movie. And I even remember reading about, because people will create fan fictions and versions where people are, characters are women or people of color. Even like Harry Potter, Hermione, technically, the way her hair was described and her character could have been a black woman. Like, I feel like people get very focused on the initial casting, and I don't know why. Like, if you are watching a movie to be in a fantasy, then let that fantasy play out. I just don't understand. Does not compute.
You want to add to that, Eileen?
Well, I was going to say, while white men might have been surprised at the backlash, I would say most women were not. We've already been through Gamergate. We already know Whitaker is going to get all sorts of threats. So it's an unfortunate thing that women share, is that's especially in the geek world, that there is a huge backlash against them participating at the same level and being experts or showrunners. Even as authors, there was a big backlash in the Nebula Awards for women, or the Hugo Awards, with women starting to win awards, that it was too politically correct. It was all motivated by politics, which is a little bit sad. So,
well, I want to listen to another clip, and I kind of want to take this conversation in a little bit more serious direction. I mean, again, I think this stuff is plenty serious. The fact that our culture just sometimes can't get over a change in the racial and gender identity of leads. But how about Santa Claus? So when Megyn Kelly was on the Fox News Channel, she got into this thing, this ongoing thing that Santa Claus was white, and she eventually defended it in certain ways that she claimed people were missing the point. But first, let's listen to one of those clips of Megyn Kelly saying that Santa has to be white.
In Slate, they have a piece on .com, Santa Claus should not be a white man anymore. And when I saw this headline, I kind of laughed, and I said, oh, this is so ridiculous. Yet another person claiming it's racist to have a white Santa, you know? And by the way, for all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white, but this person is just arguing that maybe we should also have a black Santa. But, you know, Santa is what he is, and just so you know, we're just debating this because someone wrote about it, kids.
Rest assured, children.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the problem. Well, there are a lot of problems with what she said. The original Saint Nicholas was born in Turkey. So there's chances that he was probably brown.
Get out of here.
At a minimum, he was brown. So, you know, the idea that Santa Claus was white came when people adopted Santa Claus from Saint Nicholas, adapted them to their homelands, and now, you know, he's a white guy. He's a little bit more svelte some places. Like Swedish Santa Claus is all skinny with a robe. Our Santa Claus is a little bit portly and, you know, peddling Coca-Cola products. You know, it's just, you know, that's the only thing. But like the original Saint Nicholas was a dark-skinned person from Turkey. So, yeah, I have no time for Megyn Kelly.
But Megyn Kelly, here's what she later said, Krista. Let me go ahead and try to be charitable, and then I'll tell you what really disturbed me most about that clip, and I'll let the rest of you guys jump in here. She said that what she was really riffing on was the commercialization of Santa Claus as an entity to sell Coca-Cola, as an entity to sell products that Christmas has been commercialized, and the commercialization is of a portly, bearded white man, and that there's nothing you can do to change that. Well, I don't know why there's nothing you can do to change that. But that was the defense she gave, that she wasn't saying that Santa has to be white. She's saying, but he just is, because that's how commercialization has taken it.
Okay. So, yeah, do you know what Lysol used to be marketed as? It used to be marketed as like some sort of sanitary cleanser for women. It is not that now. So by her by her thought, Lysol still needs to be in the feminine products section instead of where it belongs as a cleaning agent for things, for surfaces.
Non-biological
surfaces. Non-biological surfaces.
So you mean things can evolve, things can change.
Yeah.
That sounds like an excuse. That sounds like a bad excuse
to me.
It's
a terrible excuse.
But when she says there, and kids, we're just talking about Santa Claus, and just so you know, kids, Santa Claus is white. It's like she can't even imagine a non-white child watching that broadcast.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Well, it is.
And it's probably close to true. Mm-hmm. But Irene, doesn't that struck me as like, wow, she's only aiming this.
She didn't understand
at an audience.
That people like me hate watched Fox News with their parents. So
but let me bring it back here. Let's say you're a little girl and you hear that message. What can you take me through what the experience might be like for a child hearing that Santa Claus has to be white?
I mean, that kind of was what I did grow up with, so it seemed like kind of an accepted reality. I don't know. In my household, it was definitely those kinds of things were explained to me, though. I think if I were to see that on TV, my parents would explain to me that, no, that's not true. This woman is kind of crazy. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's something, as growing up as a black woman, you have kind of a brush off, so I don't think it would have really impacted me that strongly.
Do you worry about how it could impact other kids of color who never get to see Santa Claus? That's why I think Grease Ridge Mall, I think our new colleague, Tiana Mannion, who starts here this week, which is wonderful. She's a wonderful journalist.
Yes.
And she's going to be working alongside all of us. So we're really proud of that. And she wrote a great piece for Open Mic Rochester about Black Santa at Grease Ridge Mall and just the impact it had on just kids seeing that.
Yeah. No, there's definitely, it does have an impact. Having a erasure, whether it's in Santa Claus or in like a movie or a television franchise, it has an impact that I think you notice it once you find representation. That piece was moving because I really liked reading about how excited kids were to see a Santa Claus that was the same skin color as them or another brown person. So I think it impacts you in the way that once you finally have representation, you realize how important it is.
Chris, to you, is it more about fragility here too? Also, that just there can't be a recognition of,
of
diversity?
It's one of those things. This might be like a whole human thing, but like specifically when it comes to like usually white males, whenever their dynamic is changed, like just a little bit, like, you know, oh, the Santa Claus in the mall is black now. They just go insane. And it doesn't make any, it makes little sense to me, but like that just shows how important like inclusion and diversity is to at a minimum, a child's environment. Like if a child sees something, you know, reflected in them with, you know, something as simple as Santa Claus, then just imagine like the rest of the entertainment world or the rest of the STEM field or the rest of like the teaching field. Like imagine the impact it would have to see more people of all different races and colors and religions, you know, all together, working together, doing the same thing.
I think that's beautifully said. Jeremy, go ahead.
Yeah, I know. I just wanted to add, what I thought was sort of interesting and problematic about what Megyn Kelly said was this idea, like, somehow she has control. Like, I say that Santa Claus is white. Ooh. And, like, who gave her control? I mean, I think in the end, this is probably a more optimistic view. I hope this comes true, is that what will happen is that the commercialization of Santa as a non-copyrighted character is actually what will make things work out because progressive companies and films will start having, you know, a black Santa or a Santa, you know, a woman Santa. And that's how it will happen because they'll see that there's an audience for it, that they can sell a product that way. It's not the best way to get there, but I think that's what in a way will get us there.
Yeah, that's definitely what seems to make changes now. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And in terms of representation in Rogue One, the Star Wars film, I read a really heartbreaking story about an elderly Mexican man who, because I'm going to get his name wrong, Gil Garcia Bernal, is that who? I think that's who was in Star Wars. I apologize if I got it wrong. He saw and he kept his Mexican accent, and this man's father just cried. He had never seen anyone with a Mexican accent who wasn't a drug dealer, you know, in things like that, like a criminal in TV and in sci-fi, there's no reason not to have like all sorts of diversity, right? We can have fish people and scale people, but God forbid you have a black person, a black woman, things like that. So mm-hmm. I think everyone gets used to things and they get comfortable with things, and having feeling that change makes it feel like the balance is off, but the numbers still show it's a white man's world in terms of producing and mm-hmm. creating, and in terms of actors. You know, Dunkirk filled with white guys. Great. That's what I need, another white guy movie.
Well, let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back, and we'll take some of your phone calls if you want to call the program and weigh in. Hey, listen, maybe you disagree, maybe you agree, you want to add your thoughts. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I think I can get through the whole hour and leave the whole Confederate idea for another day, because Chris Thompson probably would go on a tear if we even went there on the next fictionalized series. Or
notes. That can be a whole you've got notes.
And what are we doing? But I think we're going to stay on this. And I also want you to hear what a children's book author talked about when she auditioned for the part of Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. She is of Asian descent, and what she learned about that experience. So let's go ahead and get that only break. We'll come back to your phone calls and discuss more with our panel. Here in studio with us is Chris Thompson. He's a comedian, writer, activist, and contributor of the Almost Tuesday show on Wayo. Irene Canyo is the creator and executive producer and co-host of No Labels Included on Wayo 104.3. Jeremy Sarakin is associate professor and program director for digital cultures and technologies and chair of the media and communication department at St. John Fisher College. Eileen Daly Boas is outreach librarian for the River Campus Libraries at the University of Rochester, and a Whovian. So Whovians, you can keep calling us too. We'll take your calls after we come back. I'm Evan Dawson, Wednesday on The Next Connections. First hour, Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren joins us in studio for the hour. The second interview with her as she runs for re-election this year. And then in our second hour, we explore the themes from the new film, The Big Sick. It's about a couple, a Muslim and a non-Muslim, dating and trying to understand cultural differences, family differences, and more. We take a look at the real-life issues from that film. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On Twitter, Paul says that he does not believe that anybody who watches The Tick does not also watch Doctor Who. He thinks those are circles within each other. Paul, it's true. I've never watched Doctor Who, and I love The Tick. I must be the only one.
I've never seen The Tick.
Oh, see?
I've watched
what?
Yeah,
so, yeah. All right, so there you go, Paul. Benjamin says, doesn't this all boil down to those who are change-averse and those who are not? I think it's much more, I think it's beyond just change-averse, Benjamin. I do think there are power components here. I mean, yes, some people are change averse. Some people have traditions or ideas in their mind that they don't want to see change. But I think so much of it, I don't know, Jeremy, doesn't it also feel like there's a power component here, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's what we've been talking about. I think it's the idea that people feel safe if they see a main character that's someone that looks like them. And if it's not, then somehow their role is threatened as well. And I think it goes very deep.
And often the people in those lead roles tend to be often white males, usually white mm-hmm. people in power.
And in Doctor Who, that argument doesn't fly because mm-hmm. Doctor Who changes all the time. So even if you're upset that David Tennant has left and he's never coming back as Doctor Who keeps changing. So it can't be just that the Doctor is changing. It has to be, in this case, some of it because of that power component.
Mm-hmm. Although it is kind of interesting, and I have a feeling it's, again, as you said, it's much more than this, but every time someone has left the show, everyone said, oh, I'm not going to watch anymore because the person who is currently the Doctor is great, and this new person is too young or too old or the hair color is wrong. Like, that's actually been an ongoing thing with the show. So this, you could say this is just a little more extreme. I think it's more than that, but it is kind of interesting that it's been an existing phenomenon.
I love Merriam-Webster's Twitter account, by the way. Merriam-Webster is like the troll.
They're so shady.
Just the best. And they recently tweeted that doctor is a word with no gender. Just leaving it out there.
Cool. Merriam-Webster. Yes.
Let me get Bonnie in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I think there's no question that dealing with change with people and some of the issues that you're talking about as adults is no easy task. I'm not sure what I'm going to say actually will work, but I think it is worth thinking about. Is one of the things I think that would be could be very positive is if we looked at our education system and looked at it in a way that dealt with some of these complex issues. So if we dealt with a full range of oppression in ways that not only talk about the history and what that means in that sense, but also how people individually incorporate that into their being, and working with ways to undo that or to examine it as you go through school, not it wouldn't be obviously in one particular year or something, but ongoing, that would help in knowing what oppression really is versus just diversity and these other things. I think that the oppression thing goes much deeper than just that, and I think it's a doable thing. I think we have not really put our heads to that, and the other really hard concepts to deal with are cognitive dissonance. I think somebody hinted a little while ago that if you find that your thing you're going to change is also going to make could put you in a position you have to look at a lot of other things. But if we do that in a way that's kind of a gradual but meaningful, and there are ways to do this, I think that part would be minimized. So I think while it's difficult, I think doing this would be worthwhile rather than just saying, well, we'll just let everybody kind of suffer or go where they want to go or whatever.
Bonnie, thank you. Teaching about oppression. A lot of people want to win. Yeah, go ahead, Jeremy.
I'll just say, I mean, I think a big question is when we start that sort of education. As a college professor, I never get the impression that a lot of that's done in the K-12 system that I can see. And so when we start introducing it, and at Fisher, across the humanities, we're dealing with all these issues. But people are really resistant, as if there was a female doctor. I mean, they're very, very, it's almost like we're getting them too late, because we have to spend half the semester sort of convincing people it's okay, to talk about it and to sort of deal with it and so forth.
You want to jump in there, Chris?
I honestly think you need to start super early. I got called the N-word the first time that I remember when I was like 4, and that's when I got my education. But that's not when other people get theirs. We'll learn about slavery. We didn't learn about slavery in school until, 7th grade. That's too late. That's 8 years of my life that I could have learned about this stuff. So I think early, don't, dump it all on them at 4, but there are ways that you can teach these things.
Yeah.
I think critical thinking is just really what's needed. I think the caller's point is correct, that it's much more complicated than just being averse to change. And people need to examine their, take a pause and think, why am I having this visceral reaction to seemingly really small change? What is the issue really? So I think if people get beneath the surface, and critical thinking is something that can certainly be taught at a young age. Kids are smart. They'll pick up on it.
I think you're right. I think there's at the young age, you can learn about what's fair and what's not, and how do we treat people, and how we made mistakes, and that we learn upon it. And one of the things is I used to teach philosophy, and earlier is better. College is a little bit too late to have people start to they've made a lot of bedrock by that point. So,
yeah.
And in sci-fi, there's a lot of bedrock too.
Let me go ahead and read a couple of emails and then we'll grab another phone call. Robert says to us, "You don't have to say it, but we're all thinking it. The people who are upset about any gender, race, or sexuality changes to fictional characters tend to be racist, homophobic, misogynists who are more likely than not salty white males." That's from Robert.
I like Robert.
Dana says, "Can I just say that as a white woman who has never watched or been interested in James Bond, if Idris Elba took that role, I'd be watching that franchise for the first time. Love that man." And Keith says, "In substitute for anticipating a fat white man coming to deliver gifts on Christmas, we've always been honest about Christmas and the real reason with our kids. Being black in America, which my family is, means constantly celebrating white achievement, plain and simple. Peppering media with brown and black people makes the experience feel more real." That's from Keith. So just some various experiences there. Let me grab Dennis in Pittsford on the phone. Go ahead, Dennis.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to make a couple of comments, observations on how things have changed in the medical world. My oldest daughter, when she was a little kid, her mom was a nurse, and we talked about, what do you want to be when you grew up? And she said, well, I want to be a nurse. And I said, well, would you like to be a doctor? And she said, oh, only boys are doctors. I mean, she's literally never met a female doctor. So I made sure that, from then on, the girls' pediatricians were women. And, you know, nowadays, I mean, no one in actual experience thinks about, you know, that all doctors are male. It's just not the case. At least half the doctors are female, and, you know, half my doctors and all my specialists are female. I mean, it's not, in other words, that's been eradicated, I think, as a practical experience. So I think, you know, the reality of actually, you know, gender and other diversity in professions, you know, will eventually change things. The other thing is in the movies. You know, I remember when Pelican Brief was made, you know, Julia Roberts played the part of the woman there, and the detective or whoever was the lead male role was by Denzel Washington. And, you know, that was nothing specified in the book, you know, Grisham's book, whether the lead was black or white. But, I mean, that was a long time ago. I just wonder if having more diverse roles in the movies affects how people envision this in books or in situations where the gender and other characteristics of a person are not specified. But just like, you know.
Yeah, Dennis, thank you. I think if it's not specified, the default assumption of most white readers is white. Mm-hmm. But probably right. I don't recall Pelican Brief. I mean, I'm familiar with the idea. I don't remember when it came out. I don't know if there was any sort of commentary about that. But yeah, why not Chris Thompson? I mean, why is it that the default is always going to be one thing?
It's just, I think it's just the way our brains work. Like,
white
we live
supremacy.
In America. Yeah, it's just, yeah, white supremacy.
Irene just did it in two words. She just answered that in two words.
Irene's very succinct. But yeah, that's the way our brains are work. If we're reared a certain way in a certain environment, that's just like, if you say, you know, there's a man walking down the street, chances are 9 out of 10 people are going to automatically think white man until you specify what the person looks like. Mm-hmm. That's just, it's unfortunate, but it's also like a default, but it's easily fixable.
Yeah, I mean, it takes some self-awareness, takes some effort. Mm-hmm. but it should be fixable. I agree with that. I've been in newsrooms where the conversation is, how come our graphic just said that the suspect is a black male, but then yesterday we had a story and the suspect was a male?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Especially when they already identified who the suspect is. Like, if you know the person's name, that's all you need to know.
Let's listen, if we could, to what Grace Lynn had to say about just the way we look at ourselves sometimes in heroes or in fictional stories. And she's a children's book author, and she talked during a TED Talk about how she auditioned for the part of Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz when she was in elementary school. And again, she's Asian. Let's listen to what Grace Lynn had to say about that.
In fifth grade, my class decided to put on the play Return to Oz. And all the girls wanted to be Dorothy, me included. So all the girls, every day at recess, all the girls who wanted to be Dorothy would stand in a circle, and we would all sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow over and over again, practicing for the audition. Until, on the day of the audition, I turned to the girl next to me, and I said, "Today's the audition. Do you think they might choose me to be Dorothy?" And she looked at me and she said, "But you can't be Dorothy. Dorothy's not Chinese." And when she said this, I felt so stupid. It was that horrible embarrassment where you get hot and red and sticky, as if even your skin is crying tiny, boiling tears. It's that feeling when someone says to you, "Who do you think you are?" And you feel like you're nobody. I felt like I was nobody. I felt like I could never be Dorothy. I could never be anyone important like that.
That's Grace Lynn.
Wow.
I'll go around the table. I'll start with you, Chris. How'd that hit you?
That actually reminds me of a couple of times when I was a kid, when I was playing, you know, superhero things, or like one time I did an audition for a Peter Pan thing, and I was pretty much told the same thing. Like, I would never be able to be Batman. I couldn't be the Flash. I couldn't be Spider-Man. I couldn't be any of them. And we were just pretending. But like that, see, that's another point. You have to start young with like this type of teaching that, you know, anybody can be anybody, and it doesn't matter what skin color or background it is, or background you have.
I hope we eventually have a world where my son can grow up and know that anybody can be anybody. And if you don't get a role, it's because you were like me. I went out for the role of the farmer in Old MacDonald, and they said, you'd probably be better as Shep the dog.
That's what they made.
It was a non-speaking part, because I was a terrible actor, but not because, I mean, look, it's always been easy for me. Mm-hmm. I've never had the experience that Chris just described, certainly never had the experience that Grace just described. I mean, Irene, what did you think when you heard that?
Well, side note, I was once a tree in a play, so I think that's probably the worst role you could be. typecasting is a thing, and it's probably, it's not really spoken about, but I was in plays too, and I was definitely, the lead roles always went to certain looking people, and not that they weren't talented, but typecasting is definitely a problem. And yeah, I think it does impact people in as powerful a way as Grace responded. Yeah, I don't know. I think that I do agree. I think it's interesting that we have this message to children that you can be anything, but then there's this like little caveat, but like you can't be Dorothy, but you can be anything else. You know what I mean?
You can't be Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and then how do they extend that throughout the rest of their lives? What messages are we sending?
It's being consistent. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Eileen, how did you respond to that clip?
Well, I was just thinking about how kids, so my husband teaches animation, and so sometimes I help him out at maker fairs, and inevitably the 3 or 4 year old has an idea, and a parent will come and say like, oh, don't they go shake hands, and the kid's got a so much better idea, and I just watch those good ideas get sort of stamped out. And that's what it reminded me of. This little girl just wants to, you know, as a girl she wants to be Dorothy, and it's the society that's like saying, oh, that imagination that you have, that doesn't cut it. That's, you can't. And it's just, and it kills me because, you know, starting with a sci-fi sort of thing, that's what we dream of. Like, the rules shouldn't apply. And here we have, you know, a little girl, you know, you can't do something because these parental voices that are defining us and in a larger, constructing gender roles, constructing who you can love and who you can't. And it's just heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking because you see all this potential. She might have been the best little Dorothy in the 5th grade play that they had ever seen, and we're never going to know. And I think that's the other thing for having so many great actors, so many great scientists who maybe don't get to do what they do because someone has said, you look wrong, or you don't have the right, you know, genitals to play that part. Mm. It's just crushing.
Jeremy, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm thinking of sort of the broader sort of theater aspect. I mean, what's interesting about listening to that clip is that the person who said it was just another little girl, which gets to all sort of the problems of sort of what they're learning. But it seems to me like outside of, you know, commercial Broadway theater, and there's been articles recently in the New York Times about how they're still not doing a very good job with a lot of these issues, smaller theaters, hopefully school theaters, because it's something we can work on because it's local, I'm hoping that this is sort of where changes are seen. Certainly even independent theater, non-professional theater in Rochester, I think is making a lot of sort of strides in this area. So, I mean, there's hope there perhaps of this changing.
Let me grab a phone call. This is Karen and Henrietta next. Go ahead, Karen.
Yes, hi. I've been in discussion groups in terms of diversity, racism, and I have to admit that, you know, I have to admit to growing up in the 50s and after World War II in a small tract of homes outside, you know, near Albany, Schenectady, New York, and I wasn't exposed to a lot of people, and I was also taught to be afraid of strangers. And as I grew older, I realized it was a very protected way of being. And after college, I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I mean, my degree, I realized, wasn't what I wanted at the time. And I became a welfare caseworker in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And as part of our job, we had to go into various city neighborhoods to do what was called a redetermination. And I remember thinking to myself, it was like, it was really like the shit hitting the fan. And I was going to go out by myself, and I was really, really aware that I was afraid and that I had no basis for it, but I was afraid anyway. And so the irony is, I go to this neighborhood and in the city, and I've never been in city neighborhoods before, and don't I lock my keys in the car? And so there was no way I was going to be able to get out and ask them for help. And there was this guy on the street, and I asked if he could help me. And I thought, I must have done that unconsciously to make sure that I confronted and challenged myself that much more. I mean, it was not a conscious thing. But if I'm in a group and I say, you know, I probably have grown up to be ignorant and therefore have some racist prejudices, then I feel like I'm saying I am really this evil person. And then I want to cry, really, because I don't feel evil. I do feel ignorant and all that. So how do you deal with a really open, honest way where is the whole group going to somehow turn on me at that point?
Wow.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, Karen, so stay there for a second. I mean, you're really peeling it back and being honest about the fact that you perceive yourself as having grown up because of those limitations of having ignorance and racism. And just, first of all, just kind of claiming that term.
Yeah, I really appreciate that honesty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I let me just start the conversation here. Stay there, because she's saying, Irene, she wants to confront this about herself.
Yeah.
But she also knows the way she will be judged it's like we've put this label on the word. If you are racist at all, you're evil. Instead of admitting that we have these prejudices, and what are we going to do about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the way to make yourself feel better is to educate yourself on it more. It sounds like you have had some hands-on education. I really like that you're like, maybe this was meant to be that I locked myself out so I could confront this. I think that's really cool. To embrace every opportunity.
I think I did.
Yeah.
I was aware of that.
Just to embrace every opportunity. And yeah, just educate yourself. And I feel like I literally sometimes will go out and like see a movie or support something just for the fact that it contains like a woman or a person of color because they need that support. Like that's something you can do if you see these movies coming out.
My life now has a lot of people of color in it.
Great.
Good.
Yeah, go out and see those movies and like support black industries.
After I retired, I worked in city schools and I loved it, absolutely loved it. And however, I do know that my upbringing wasn't what you're all talking about. Like, my upbringing didn't say be close-minded, but it didn't say the open, you know.
Yeah.
I was just brought up in a very sheltered way, and nobody said, think about the big world. And, you know, the biggest thing I thought about was I'm Jewish, and look at all the people in the neighborhood, in the school district, and that who aren't, and they want to start school on a high holiday. That was it. That was my level of being different, and I felt different. I really appreciate what you are all saying. And I think you're right. But I think education, I think it's exposure. And somehow to say, well, let's all sit around and be honest, it's hard.
No, Karen, I just got to let the panel kind of, let me go back around the table because it's a sort of this really gripping way to end this conversation, very honest. Anything you want to add, Irene, as well?
No, I just think it's supposed to be hard, so it's that's what it is. Yeah. And so you're doing it right, probably.
Okay, Chris?
Yeah, I'm just going to piggyback off of what Irene said. Like, you know, it sounds like she's doing the work. Admitting that you have, like, this in your head is the first step, and like having now experienced, you know, interactions with other people of color and people of different religions, you're doing some of the work already. So I would suggest going out, maybe even just going out, you know, I'm sure she likes books. Go out to like the library and pick up some books like on African American history, on women's history, on there are a couple of books and there are a couple of articles about how African Americans and Jewish people together like were working in the civil rights movement. Like, you know, find that thread that you can identify with because you're from it, and then just like venture off from there.
I know, Eileen, you always appreciate the admonition to go to the library.
I do. Librarians always say ignorance is not a permanent condition, and I think the caller's working hard to overcome that. So, good on her.
Yeah, Jeremy, about 20 seconds. Final thoughts there.
Okay, I'll just say that going back to where we started, being more open to new ideas and to sort of a diversity of opinions just leads to better stories and more stories, and that's sort of good for all of us.
I agree with that, and I'll just say this, Karen, as well. I know how you feel, that nervousness to admit that because what it means, but hey, I'll join you. I'm the host of this program. I get to talk to a lot of enlightened people, a lot smarter than me, and sometimes it comes off that I'm sort of speaking from the mountaintop, but I am not. I'm with you. I don't think there's two doors in the world, racist or not racist, and congratulations, you're not a racist. It's a sliding scale in understanding prejudices, and I have it, and I'm working with you to do that, and I appreciate you at least kind of grabbing onto that and being willing to talk about it, so thank you. And thank you to
thanks
our,
for sharing that.
Thanks for our panel as well, Irene Canyo, Chris Thompson, Eileen Daly-Boas, Jeremy Sarakin, wonderful stuff. I really appreciate all your perspectives. Thank you for being here. Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We're back with you Wednesday on member-supported public radio.